From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It's a shame, and we say it all the time, there ought to be a crime against spreading ignorance, especially among an oppressed people. There really ought to be a crime. When you get up to speak before an oppressed people, you ought to be certain that what you say is the absolute truth. Otherwise, you ought to sit down and keep your mouth shut and not spread it.
Kwame Ture is dead. The former SNCC leader coined the term black power. We'll hear a speech. We'll also get a live report from Baghdad. And we'll have a report from California, where a hunger strike has begun by University of Southern California employees. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bill Clinton called off not one but two attacks against Iraq, halting the second strike early yesterday morning after deciding to accept Iraq's offer to resume UN inspections. The U.S. officials who disclosed this information disclosed the second strike as they offered details of the White House's actions from Friday through Sunday as it reacted to Baghdad's offers to let UN inspectors resume searching for Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. It seems not all of President Clinton's top advisors agreed with his decision to pull the plug on airstrikes on Iraq. The Washington Post cites administration sources who say National Security Advisor Sandy Berger favored suspending the attacks, but Defense Secretary William Cohen, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and General Henry Shelton, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reportedly wanted to go ahead despite an Iraqi offer to comply with UN weapons inspections. The newspaper says the debate among Clinton and his advisors took place over the telephone Saturday morning after the first broadcast news reports of Iraq's offer. The Post says Vice President Gore also took part in the discussions, but sources won't confirm what his position was. Meanwhile, Iraq has declared itself the victor in the dispute. Vice President Tai Yassin Ramadan told state-run television that Iraq had been able to, quote, prove to the whole world that our views are correct and that the Americans were misguided. It was the first official reaction to the weekend's tumultuous events, and the rhetoric obviously was for local consumption in a country weary of UN sanctions and of being isolated even from its Arab neighbors. As UN weapons inspectors prepare to head back to Iraq, relief workers are also returning to Baghdad. About 150 UN humanitarian workers should be back in Iraq today. They were evacuated to Jordan last week because of threatened U.S. airstrikes. The weapons inspectors should be back to work tomorrow, now that Saddam Hussein has promised to cooperate with the monitors. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz reiterated the commitment to cooperate with UN weapons inspections, but condemned President Clinton's call for a new government in Baghdad. Kwame Ture, who, as Stokely Carmichael, made the phrase black power a rallying cry of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, died yesterday in Guinea-Conakry. A member of Ture's All-African People's Revolutionary Party said he was 57. Ture died of prostate cancer, which he'd been fighting for the past 2 years. He received treatment for the illness in Cuba. We'll have more on that later in the show. This news from Indonesia. Student protests in Indonesia resumed today, but today's demonstrations are peaceful compared to what has been happening over the last days. The Indonesian military opening fire. At least 16 deaths have been reported. Reiterating calls for democratic reforms and the resignation of top military leaders, students in Jakarta placed wreaths along the street outside a Catholic university where security forces shot and killed students with plastic bullets last week. Meanwhile, the government is flexing its muscles as well, with troops backed by armored personnel carriers and small tanks ringing the presidential palace and parliament. This news from Chile. Former Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet will be moved to a hospital nearer an air base where two planes remain waiting for him to fly home. Actually, that news from Britain. Chilean newspapers said Pinochet, who turns 83 on November 25th, will be moved as soon as today to a location closer to the air base near London. The Chilean Air Force has two planes there ready to bring him home should he be released. This news from Washington, Kenneth Starr is testifying before Congress this week, but he could face legal troubles of his own. Members of the House Judiciary Committee will grill him Thursday about his probe of President Clinton, focusing on Starr's motives and tactics. While Democrats will try to portray him as a right-wing, Republicans say this will be Starr's best opportunity to make his case against Clinton. Meanwhile, Newsweek says the tables may soon be turned on Starr because the Justice Department is close to launching an ethics inquiry into Starr's handling of the Monica Lewinsky case. The magazine says the probe would focus on whether Starr was out of line when he confronted Lewinsky about her relationship with President Clinton and allegedly discouraged her from talking with an attorney, saying if she called an attorney, she would not be granted immunity. Well, Iraq says it will be allowing in weapons inspectors once again, but the situation seems to be changing at every moment. In the latest move in the world's most expensive game of cat and mouse, President Clinton yesterday accepted Iraq's promise to allow weapons inspections to resume, but warned Baghdad that the U.S. remains poised to attack weapons facilities if Iraq refuses to cooperate once more. Many of Iraq's Arab allies, as well as U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, have also warned President Saddam Hussein that he will bear responsibility for U.S. military attacks if he again refuses to allow weapons inspections. This development comes after a massive U.S. military mobilization that brought heavy bombers and Patriot missile launchers to the Persian Gulf. As these developments unfold, the Iraqi population continues to suffer from the seven-year-old economic embargo. According to UNICEF figures, around 8,000 children die as a result of the UN-imposed embargo. More than 500,000 children have died since the embargo was imposed. That's 8,000 children die a month as a result of the UN-imposed embargo. We're joined right now by a few people to update us on the situation. We first go to Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill, who has just recently arrived in Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us what the latest is in Baghdad?
Well, Amy, there's been an apparently stunning development in things here. A spokesperson for the foreign ministry told us just a short time ago that the Chinese, Russian, and Polish embassies have all evacuated their personnel earlier today. This is particularly stunning because China and Russia have supported Iraq in this recent confrontation with the United States and the United Nations, speaking against a military attack on Iraq. Of interest, the Polish embassy houses the U.S. interest section here in Baghdad, which operates in lieu of an embassy. And many people here are viewing this with enormous suspicion. I can't say enough on how suspicious people are here. I know that President Clinton has called for a new government in Baghdad. There have been sort of two tracks to the rhetoric, one involving the UNSCOM team and that being a rationale or a justification for an airstrike. But there's also been Clinton calling for a new government. And what I just heard you read in the news headlines about some dissent within the administration would seem to make sense. But people here are very suspicious. Once again, Chinese, Russian, and Polish embassies, we believe, we were told this by a foreign ministry spokesperson, have evacuated their personnel earlier today. And it has come as a stunning and curious development.
Well, that's very interesting, considering at the same time UN weapons inspectors are supposedly going back into the country. What do people understand in Iraq right now? Have they heard that at this point, this attack has been called off, at least for today?
Well, they did hear last night on the news, Taya Yassin Ramadan saying that Iraq had won this recent confrontation with the U.S. and the United Nations. But generally, people are not right up to the minute with their information, and I don't think that many of the people, the average people on the streets, are aware of the blow-by-blow developments with all of this. I think people's information seems to be dated by between 3 days to a week. But this is stunning, those people that we have been able to touch base with, that these particular embassies have evacuated their personnel. Of course, there was the evacuation earlier, a few days ago, of UN personnel and some other embassy officials from other embassies. But this comes as a stunning development that China and Russia have reportedly evacuated their embassies, and the Polish embassy as well, where the U.S. Interest section is housed. And some people are saying that this may be tied to some of the rhetoric that has come out of Washington consistently for years about a new government in Baghdad, and you know, President Clinton's saying that they want a more pro-U.S. government involved. So some people are speculating that that may be part of this. Once again, China and Russia, of course, have been supportive of Baghdad over the years and in this most recent crisis by speaking out against the use of military force.
Jeremy, how did you get into Iraq?
Well, we flew into Amman, Jordan. It was about a 13-hour flight before we eventually landed in Amman. And then we had to take a 13-hour ride into Iraq, into Baghdad. We arrived about 48 hours ago in Baghdad and have been, you know, visiting hospitals and other things since. But we took the same road into Baghdad from Amman that was taken out of Iraq by the UN personnel that evacuated just a few days ago. And it was interesting. We talked to people along the way, and they described seeing these UN vehicles moving out, a caravan of UN personnel. But once we got into Iraq, we found that very few people knew that the UN had even evacuated. And those that did know were people that actually saw it happening. So we arrived in Baghdad and checked into our hotel. And then early this morning, we went to the Saddam General Hospital here in Baghdad. And they are still in a state of emergency at Saddam General Hospital. They have converted the intensive care unit, which is located at the bottom of the building, into a bomb shelter. And they have not removed that function from the intensive care unit. Doctors there, though, say that state of emergency is really a semantic thing because they say that they're always in a state of emergency at their hospitals with devastation caused by the U.S.-led U.N. sanctions. I know Dennis Halliday told the New York Times that 6,000 children were dying every month because of these sanctions. And this doctor said that he is losing about six children every 24 hours in that hospital alone. So the state of emergency comes from both the military angle and the continuing threats by the United States, as well as the sanctions that Washington pushes so hard at the United Nations that have just been devastating to the Iraqi people. And, you know, the feeling here is that the United States bombing Iraq is to further punish a people that are suffering enormously under these sanctions. And that is the general sense on the street. And they're asking, why punish us more? They're saying to me, Why does your government do this to us? We are already suffering, and now they may bomb us.
You know, it's interesting you raise the issue of sanctions. They're not often raised in the papers as they talk about Saddam Hussein just, again, not cooperating with UNSCA monitors and not allowing them in. But there is a photograph in the Washington Post today. It is a picture, and under it, it says, UNSCA monitors prepare to leave Baghdad after Iraq's October 31st announcement that it was halting cooperation with weapons inspectors until the United Nations reviewed sanctions imposed after the Persian Gulf War. We rarely see in the press that the reason that the inspectors were once again not allowed to work is because Iraq was calling for a review of these sanctions. Jeremy, last question, and that is who you came in with. Can you talk about who is part of the most recent voices in the wilderness delegation, the Chicago-based group with whom you traveled?
Yes, I did travel over here with members of Voices in the Wilderness, which is a Chicago-based organization that really has been perhaps the most forceful voice in the United States against the U.S.-led United Nations sanctions, a team of people who are nonviolent, who break U.S. law by delivering tons of medical aid to the people of Iraq each year. The delegation is headed by the group's leader, Kathy Kelly, who is based in Chicago, and Kathy's name is well known here in Iraq. People do recognize her and come up to her on the street. But Voices in the Wilderness has engaged in a lengthy campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience to U.S. law that says that American citizens should not on their own be delivering medicine and food to the people of Iraq. And they're continuing to do that, and they threw this delegation together really at the last minute when it seemed imminent, and when it seemed imminent that the United States was in fact going to bomb Iraq. The position of the group here now is that the threat is not over, that regardless of if it's military or economic, the people of Iraq are suffering. They believe that the use of food and medicine in war is a war crime, a violation of international law, and they say that as U.S. citizens, that they are bound by conscience to break those laws, violate those laws, and stand with the Iraqi people in what may happen over the next few days, few weeks, or few months.
Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Producer in Baghdad right now. Jeremy, we are also joined in our studio here in New York by Farhan Haq. He is a reporter with Interpress Service, a third world news agency, and he's based at the United Nations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Farhan.
Hi, Amy.
Well, a lot has happened over the weekend at the United Nations. Can you tell us how this latest situation that we're in today unfolded?
Well, basically, the big question was the letter which the Iraqis sent to the United Nations on Saturday. Apparently, according to most reports, the letter came just as the planes, the U.S. warplanes, were in the sky. And what the letter said was that the UN weapons inspectors, UNSCOM, would be in fact allowed in unconditionally. The problem was the two-page annex to the letter, which the U.S. initially interpreted until they received further clarifications from Iraq as conditions about what Iraq would want to see from any sort of review by the United Nations of their relations with Iraq, such as a phased-out end to sanctions. But once Iraq had explained that this was simply what they would like to see rather than any conditions that they were putting on the weapons inspectors' returns, then by Sunday the matter was well resolved. Although in this case, it's interesting to notice that the matter was essentially resolved because of what happened with Iraq and with the United States and what their positions were, rather than a lot of the things that happened at the United Nations itself, where much of the discussion was after the fact.
How do you think Iraq knew, or Saddam Hussein knew, Tariq Aziz knew, that the B-52 bombers were just a half hour away, because the letter came, as you were saying, just then, in that last hour, apparently, according to the last reports, before the U.S. was about to attack?
I don't really know whether they necessarily knew that the planes were in the sky. Certainly, they were aware. Once the UN weapons inspectors and most of the UN personnel left on Wednesday and Thursday, Iraq was aware, as were most of the diplomats at the United Nations, that that an attack was imminent. Whether they knew that it was happening on Saturday, whether they had particular intelligence about that and timed the letter for that, is another question. Certainly, it seems that even on Friday, Iraq was willing to come out with such a letter. As the UN Security Council met Friday evening, in fact, Saddam Hussein had already indicated in a public speech that they were willing to accept a compromise. And so it may just be that it may not be so much that they timed the letter to come out when the warplanes were coming, but that the United States might have tried as hard as they could to speed up the actions of their warplanes so that you couldn't actually forestall it by sending a letter.
Farhan Haq, tell us about the role of Kofi Annan in all of this, the UN Secretary General, or is it really simply a confrontation between the U.S. and Iraq?
No, he actually played a role, and it was a fairly sophisticated move. In February, he went to Baghdad directly and negotiated directly with Saddam Hussein and came out with a memorandum of understanding which allowed for the return of the inspectors that time and forestalled the conflict in February. This time around, he knew that he did not have the support from the United States and was not sure that he had any good bargaining posture from Iraq to go, so he had made it very clear that he didn't want to go or that the time was not right for him to go to Baghdad. At the same time, though, he did in many ways help prod the Security Council along so that by Friday they were able to send the Iraqi government a letter clarifying that they would be willing to review their relations with Iraq if the inspectors returned. and that helped give Iraq an excuse to climb down and save face.
We're talking to Farhan Haq. He is a reporter at the United Nations for the Interpress Service, a third world news agency. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by Dennis Halliday, the former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations and former head of the Oil for Food program, resigned a month ago in protest of how economic sanctions are affecting the Iraqi population. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to cover the latest in the Persian Gulf, again, the last news that, in fact, there was not one but two attacks against Iraq that were called off this weekend. President Clinton halting the second strike early yesterday morning after deciding to accept Iraq's offer to resume UN inspections. We're joined in the studio here in New York by Farhan Haq, who is a reporter at the UN for the Interpress Service, a third world news agency. And we're joined on the telephone by Dennis Halliday, former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations and former head of the Oil for Food program. We had him on just a few weeks ago. He resigned 1 month ago in protest of how economic sanctions are affecting the Iraqi population. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dennis Halliday.
Thank you, and good morning, Amy.
It's good to be with you. I understand we're speaking to you in the Bahamas. Tell us what your take is now on the situation. Something that is not as much emphasized as usual by the press is the role that the sanctions are continuing to play in Iraq.
Well, I must say, first of all, I'm delighted that no military strike took place. I think it would have been another tragedy. It would have indeed constituted further punishment of innocent people who were not involved in decision-making vis-a-vis Kuwait or otherwise. And I think it leaves the door open now to a new period when perhaps we can explore other ways of working with Iraq and bring to an end the sanctions, which, as the Minister of Trade said recently in Baghdad himself, is killing more people than probably the strike itself would have accomplished.
What about this issue of sanctions and how little people understand in this country what is going on around them? I mean, I think the latest that if you took a poll of people in the United States, they would say that once again, Saddam Hussein didn't allow in the weapons inspectors, which is true, or wouldn't cooperate with them. But they don't say the second part of it, which is that he said until the United Nations reviewed sanctions imposed after the Persian Gulf War, the idea that the war has continued whether bombs fall or not.
Perhaps, Amy, people in the States do not appreciate how devastating these sanctions are and how all-comprehensive they are. They impact on every aspect of Iraqi life, and they've prevented the country from rebuilding itself after the damage created by the coalition forces. It's not only sustained a program of malnutrition in that the funds allocated for this program have been inadequate to provide a balanced diet for the 23 million Iraqi people. Likewise, the health situation has remained deplorably bad. I think Jeremy Scarto just mentioned he'd been to Saddam Hussein Hospital, where death continues, as we've noted, and UNICEF has noted. Further, I think the whole collapse of the civilian infrastructure is perhaps not fully understood, and that means that people have lost their homes, their health, their future, their education, opportunities for a normal life, employment, and so on. It's a catastrophic situation, and it's difficult to visualize that sitting in New York or Washington or somewhere else in this secure part of the world.
So really, does Saddam Hussein have anything to lose if there is a bombing, considering the number of lives, what is the estimate now by the UN, 8,000 a month, that are being lost as a result of the sanctions?
I think he has a responsibility towards his own people, which he clearly feels, and I think by allowing a strike to take place, he would have been heavily criticized for that by his Arab neighbors, by his own people, and by domestic politics, which is alive and well in Baghdad. He's not an isolated person. He has a constituency to consider. But the fact is that sanctions are doing tremendous damage without any additional strikes.
Do you see these sanctions being lifted anytime soon? I mean, it seems that with something like this, the situation that has just taken place, that sanctions are even further away from being lifted.
Well, it doesn't look very comforting superficially, but I think I'm just hoping that this experience, which again has shown that force is not an option that can seriously be used by this country or any other, that there will now be more serious thinking about opening up some dialogue. I understand there's pressure, of course, to change a government, but that's an issue of sovereignty, which is going to be very hard to resolve. The sanctions do not encourage democracy in Iraq, if that's what member states feel. And therefore, I think a much bigger and larger solution has got to be found, which I believe would be a dialogue amongst the member nations involved of the Gulf area to discuss the needs of these various countries and see how they interrelate with each other. One cannot look at Iraq or Iran or Kuwait alone. It's a community, a large community and an important one, that needs to be looked at as one and resolved as one, and each member nation having some of its concerns resolved.
Dennis Halliday with us, former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. Farhan Haq of Interpress Service covering the United Nations. We heard earlier Jeremy Scahill in downtown Baghdad talking about the Russian, Chinese, and Polish embassies in Baghdad being evacuated now, which is somewhat puzzling considering many reports now are coming out that the imminent threat of a U.S. attack is now over for the time being. What is the role of Russia and China on the U.N. Security Council, which met latest yesterday afternoon?
Well, Russia, China, and France are the three permanent, which is to say veto-holding members of the Security Council, who have been most adamant against the use of force in this conflict, and also who have been the strongest proponents of some effort to eventually phase out sanctions or in some other way reward Iraq for its cooperation with the UN weapons inspectors. Basically, their argument is you have to give the Iraqi government some incentive to keep up with this program. After 8 years of sanctions, in many ways, they question whether there is any incentive at all. So if what Jeremy says is in fact true, that Russia and China have also joined with the Polish embassy in pulling out their people, this is a fairly bad sign, and it is a fairly strong sign that even though within the Security Council there's now been a less tense mood over the weekend about the attacks, that even Iraq's allies think that this matter is not in fact over, and that there may in fact be an attack this week if they're so quick to leave.
Do you have a sense there could well be one this week?
Well, the United States has basically said two things yesterday. When President Clinton talked, he said on the one hand that they were going to accept Iraq's climb down over the weekend, and that they were going to test it by making sure that UNSCOM would have, you know, the UN weapons inspectors would have the freedom to conduct what he called unfettered inspections. On the other hand, he said very clearly that they wanted to strengthen the democratic opposition in Iraq. And Sandy Berger, the national security advisor, when he was on CNN yesterday, did not even deny when a CNN reporter asked him whether they might try to assassinate Saddam Hussein despite the rule in the U.S. against doing so, did not even comment on that or say, well, you know, we don't actually kill foreign leaders, which is a rather stunning thing to see, and that may be the sort of signal that the Russians and the Chinese were responding to.
Well, it's interesting you raise that, Farhan, because in today's Washington Post, there's an interesting article on a policy shift on the part of the U.S., It says in what a senior advisor described as an important policy statement that the president intended to highlight, Clinton declared flatly that he not only hopes for a change of regime in Baghdad, but will work for it and intensify that effort. If he's serious, it means nothing less than a shift from containment to overthrow as his ultimate objective, a decision neither President George Bush nor Clinton chose to make before. The Washington Post article goes on to say, this is an unusual and awkward ambition to speak aloud in the world of diplomacy, an overt, covert operation to overthrow a sovereign government, as one senior intelligence official put it, and the announcement is driven in part by U.S. politics. But the underlying decision, three defense and foreign policy officials told the Washington Post, is genuine and goes beyond Clinton's public offer of political support for the regime's opponents. What is the response at the United Nations for this public announcement of a policy to overthrow, try to have Saddam Hussein overthrown?
Well, there's been no public response to this so far. But obviously, you can't, on the one hand, say Iraq has to play by the rules and we're just trying to make sure that Iraq disarms itself and then we will abide by the rules for lifting of sanctions. And you can't say that with one side of your mouth and then with the other side of your mouth say, oh, by the way, we're trying to kill this guy. In the world of diplomacy, I can't help but think that that will be, in fact, to the detriment of the United States. If it wants to be credible in its own arguments about why the sanctions should be kept on, you can't have it that the sanctions should be kept on because of Iraqi policy, and then basically be in an unofficial state of war. And I don't think that Russia or China or France would accept that.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Farhan Haque, for joining us. Farhan Haque, the reporter at the United Nations for Interpress Service, a third world news agency. And thank you to Dennis Halliday, joining us from the Bahamas, former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations and former head of the Oil for Food program. Tomorrow on Democracy Now, we will be speaking live to Robert Fisk, who has come to the United States for a little while. Robert Fisk, the Lebanon-based correspondent for the Independent newspaper based in Britain. He's been based in Lebanon for the past two decades. He'll be sharing his analysis of the Middle East and the Persian Gulf from the vantage point of Lebanon. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And right now we turn to the latest news that's come out of Africa from Guinea, and that is Kwame Ture is dead. Kwame Ture, known to many Americans as Stokely Carmichael, died yesterday in Conakry, Guinea, 57 years old, suffering from prostate cancer for the past 2 years. Ture is known for coining the term black power that became emblematic of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. He also was one of the people responsible for Martin Luther King's outspoken opposition to the Vietnam War. Kwame Ture was a member of the Black Panther Party for a period of time, chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC. He rejected scholarships from several white universities and entered Howard University in 1960. He joined the Freedom Rides at the end of his freshman year, where blacks and whites challenged segregated interstate travel by riding together on buses on Freedom Rides through the South. He was jailed numerous times for his activism and spent time at the notorious Parchman Penitentiary in Mississippi. Kwame Ture was a strong advocate of Pan-Africanism. He changed his name in 1978 from Stokely Carmichael to Kwame Ture. He named himself after Kwame Nkrumah, the founding president of Ghana, and Ahmed Sekou Ture, president of Guinea. He was a close friend of both. Kwame Ture was once married to the South African singer Miriam Makeba. He lived in Guinea for much of the last 30 years of his life. Today, we bring you an excerpt of a speech Kwame Ture made at New York University in 1994.
As I have breath in my body,
I want to thank you for your rousing introduction and your rousing welcome. We, of course, are not lecturers, we are organizers. We use lecturing as a means of organizing. If we were to give a statement about the conditions of our people today, we would say it is the best of times, and it is the worst of times. It is the worst of times, certainly, in that the capitalist system, finally arriving at its final crisis, is having serious problems everywhere, and being a racist capitalist system, we are the first to feel the heat of the system. It is the worst of times because the capitalist system, recognizing that it is impossible to stop revolution, is doing everything possible to slow it down. It is the worst of times because the enemy, recognizing that even though our people fight spontaneously against it, their spontaneous uprisings get greater and greater, which assure them that it will finally lead to organization, is doing everything to stop organization in our community. This assault was properly planned beginning in the 1960s, when the system saw that with the slightest organization, our people were able to wreak havoc on the system. Therefore, through every means possible, they came to wreck and destroy all the organizations. Thus, it is the worst of the time for us because we're such a disorganized people. It's the worst of times for us because while being a disorganized people, the capitalist system is heaping all of its evils upon us. It is the worst of times for us because with all these contradictions, we ourselves come to be corrupted by the system and begin to divide ourselves among ourselves. We say while it is the worst of time, it is the best of times. Of course, one of the best of times must be properly understood within the culture of Africa. Africans are always used to having a rough life. They do not know anything easy. Frederick Douglass coined it for them when he said, "Where there is no struggle, there is no progress." These Africans like to struggle. You must not allow the capitalist system to come to twist our culture and make it appear as if we do not like to struggle. In the Caribbean, where I was born, the Africans there say in their sing-song English, "The rougher the water, the stronger the swimmer." In Baton Rouge, they say, "If you see me fighting with a bear, help the bear pour honey on me." Thus, it is the best of times because we have serious struggle before us. And since struggle brings progress, the more you struggle, the more progress you make. It is the best of times for us because while the capitalist system can destroy our organizations and put us in crisis, they cannot stop the rising consciousness of the masses of the people. And this is what makes revolution. So it's the worst of times because we're disorganized, but it's the best of times because our consciousness is rising at a rapid pace. Our job is to push it higher, quicker. This aspect of consciousness must be properly understood. We are revolutionaries here. We never play with reform. We knew instinctively from the time we were young that the capitalist system cannot be reformed. It must be destroyed. Therefore, we do not play with programs aimed at reforming the capitalist system. Our only job is to aim at programs destroying the capitalist system. Of course, when you come to destroy a system, you must question the values of the system. Many of our people seeking progress inside the capitalist system do not question the values of the capitalist system. They enter the capitalist system, and before you know it, they're as corrupt as the worst capitalist pig that sold us from Africa. One, we say, when one speaks of revolution, speaks of questioning the values of the society. And as revolutionaries, this is our task. We properly understand that when one comes to question the values of the society and move against the values of the society, one is involved in difficult struggle. One is involved in difficult struggle. We want to outline for you, within the broad remarks we've made about the worst of times and the best of times, just about two or three concepts to show you how, as revolutionaries, I want to tell you something now. We know there's victory for all oppressed peoples. We don't care how long it takes. We are not speeding up the fight at all. On the contrary, we are prepared as guerrillas to wage a protracted struggle to wear the enemy down over a period of time until we wear him out for all time. Consequently, we want to tell you from the very beginning that we're not afraid, we're not upset, we're not nervous. Everyone must know that in the world there is a dialectical opposite to every aspect of life. Every aspect of life. The other day while I was speaking, a man came to see me after speaking and said, Kwame Ture, you know, the one thing I don't like about you is that you're so full of hatred, and it comes true. I told him, yes, I have a passionate hatred for injustice. Passionate. So, well, as for him, he's a Christian and he has no hatred. I laughed at him. He got upset, but I'm a revolutionary. Truth never quivers before lies. On the contrary, it crushes lies without pity and without mercy. I laughed louder. Who do you mean? You're a Christian? Yes. And you have no hatred? No. So do you love Satan? So do you love sin? If you're a Christian and love God, you better hate Satan. And you better hate Satan with all your might and all your force. If you hate something about Satan and like some other things about Satan, you are finished. If you hate Satan but likes the way Satan dresses, you are finished. Satan will just tell you, I just had a suit tailor-made for you. Why don't you try it on? Therefore, we recognize that wherever there's one aspect of life, there's always the opposite aspect to life. The capitalist system gives us what is known as a one-sided view of history, a one-sided view of reality, a one-sided view of life, always giving one side but never the other side. Since everything has two sides, we must be aware. Whenever examining anything, we must look for the opposites inside of that which we are examining.
Kwame Ture making a speech in 1994 at New York University. Kwame Ture, also known as Stokely Carmichael, died yesterday at home in Conakry, Guinea. He was 57 years old. He died of prostate cancer. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak to Reverend James Lawson of Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles, about Kwame Ture and also about a union organizing effort that's taking place in Los Angeles at the state's largest private employer, University of Southern California. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. And before we move on to our last subject today, which is a fast that's beginning today in Los Angeles, protesting the labor practices and other practices of the University of Southern California, I thought we'd get a quick comment from one of our guests, Reverend James Lawson, about Kwame Ture. I had the privilege of meeting Reverend Lawson on Saturday night when I was in Los Angeles at his church, the Holman Unitas Methodist Church, which is based in South Central Los Angeles. Reverend Lawson is a longtime civil rights leader, former advisor to the Reverend Martin Luther King, and knew Kwame Ture. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend Lawson.
Thank you.
Your thoughts on this day after Kwame Ture passed in Guinea, Africa?
Well, they're quite mixed, of course. You've just informed me of his death because I hadn't heard any news yesterday. I hadn't paid any attention to television or radio news at all in the process of the day. So I just learned of it this morning, and I'm saddened, of course, by it because I first met Kwame in 1960 when he was active in the sit-in campaigns in Maryland and Howard University, where he was then a student. I later was in jail with him in Jackson, Mississippi in 61 and spent time with him in different meetings in the Southern Movement in 61 and 62 and other times, of course, since then. Was a participant with him in the 1966-67 Meredith March Against Fear in Mississippi, where when he floated the now familiar Black Power slogans, and apparently joined Martin King and the rest of us in that struggle in order, indeed, to lift that slogan. So I had a deep respect for Kwame across the years because of his keen intellect and his passion to change the cruelty and injustice that we saw and met and all across our own country, but across basically across the world. So I'm saddened by his death, especially since in more recent years, with his prostate cancer, he continued to work diligently at his own goals. And I'm certain died in peace.
You said your reaction was mixed. What do you mean?
Well, mixed because he certainly was one of the voices, one of the people who could have helped us move from the 60s into a new construction of the movement and into a construction that would continue what we began in the 60s in a dynamic fashion. Now, let me say what I meant by that also, something else. That is, by 1966, 67, 68, many of us recognized that we had only carried out a kind of an initial development of the struggle from 55 to 66, 67. Martin King talked about this on a number of occasions in 66. Dr. King and I had a number of private conversations about it. And as late as 67, December of 67, in one of our retreats, we went off together two or three times and talked at length about this, that we had that we were too loosely structured in SCLC and SNCC, that we had mostly primarily been managed to get after the cosmetic things, that while we had seen the progress from that, we had not yet really tackled the deep issues of what he called in 67 and many of us called the trinity of evils, racism, militarism, and greed, materialism, that those structures were very deep in America and that they had to be challenged. At the same time, the those of us in the movement were working far too spontaneously. That is, we were reacting to all the different challenges that came from various people and cities, and we were not really setting, in a way, our agenda, and we did not have the structures to set an agenda for the next stage and next development. And Dr. King had agreed, in fact, he and I had agreed in December of 67, that as soon as the Poor People's Campaign was done, we were going to move towards a moratorium of action while we evaluated and assessed the situation and sought to see how then we could, in a very real way, restructure ourselves. And he was acutely concerned for the restructuring of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his own organization. So the point I make is that Kwame was one of the people in the struggle at that time who needed to be figuring out how we could put together, to use one of the words he liked, that a word also that I used in the 60s, so that we could become a more revolutionary movement. Revolutionary, from my judgment, not in terms of the violence that was going on in places like Central America, but revolutionary in respect to how we could better mobilize and recruit and structure ourselves for social change. I differed greatly with Kwame because I saw no possibility of, quote, a violent revolutionary group in the United States. I thought practically that's an impossibility. Where you have, and of course the social theorist would tell you this and say this, that where you have a great monopoly on violence in a society and the possibility of bringing to life a violent group of some kind that could overthrow that violence are pretty much impossible. And as I used to say in the 60s then, if you think that you can beat the local police in Los Angeles, all right, but then are you ready to also then beat the State Highway Patrol and the National Guard and then the Navy, Army, and Air Force of the United States, the CIA, the FBI? And no such groups could do that. And any such effort from a point of view of violence would have required a long period of underground work, very hidden work, that would produce the necessary strategy whereby this violent society could be challenged. And of course, from the other side of the coin, from a nonviolent perspective, I was also persuaded that a violent effort would not produce anything except greater tragedy, greater pain, and casualty to the African American community and to the poor community.
Reverend James Lawson, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts on Kwame Ture and his views. It's just a coincidence that we had already scheduled to have you on, actually, to talk about another issue that you actually knew Kwame Ture well throughout his years. Again, Kwame Ture died yesterday in Guinea, for listeners who are just tuning in, of prostate cancer. He was 57 years old, former chair of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a member before he quit of the Black Panther Party. But Reverend James Lawson, talking about social change, you're involved in a myriad of issues in South Central Los Angeles, where you are pastor at the Holman United Methodist Church. And one of the issues you're involved with is coming to a head today. After 3.5 year struggle over union contracts, food service and housing workers at the University of Southern California are today beginning a fast to protest the university's refusal to provide them with contracts. About 17,000 employees that work at USC. It's the largest private employer in the city of Los Angeles. Local Union 11, the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union that represents around 300 USC workers, says for the past few years, the university has been hiring more and more workers by subcontracting service jobs, depriving long-term workers of benefits and job security rights. And the backdrop for the struggle is your community, South Central Los Angeles, the primarily low-income Latino and African-American community where USC's campus is located. Community leaders repeatedly complaining that the university's administration has maintained a racist position vis-a-vis South Central residents, pointing to a USC strategy document that calls the surrounding community an environmental threat. In addition to Reverend James Lawson, we're joined by Maria Elena Durazo, president of Local 11 since 1989.
who has led a movement to have this local lead the movement into a militant force in Los Angeles. Can you talk just in the few minutes we have left about this protest today? Maria Elena Durazzo.
I'm sorry. Good morning. Yes, what we're doing is we're starting this fast, and that we will be joined, workers of USC, food service workers will be joined with religious leaders from the immediate churches in the area as well as churches throughout Los Angeles. We will have faculty and students of USC join us. And what we're looking for, basically, is to show that the strength of the community is united behind finding a fair resolution to this dispute so that workers on the campus are treated more fairly. And these, in fact, are workers who live in the immediate community. They work at USC. They live in the immediate neighborhoods of USC. They go to church in the churches surrounding USC. And their children go to the schools surrounding USC. And it is there is a strong, now joint community and worker effort to make sure that USC treats the community with greater respect.
I wanted to ask James Lawson. This is your area. I know at the University of Southern California graduation that you led an alternative graduation in the streets of South Central that led to many arrests as civil disobedience as you were giving out diplomas of justice while the USC graduation was going on. Can you put this struggle, the hunger strike that's beginning today, in the larger context of your community?
Yes. Yes, well, I want to say that when we talk of the South Central communities surrounding USC, we're talking about a highly dynamic and vital community. It is not a community simply of low-income people. It's a very mixed community. There are, within 5 minutes of USC, all sorts of both middle-class and affluent people. All sorts of professions, from the medical to education to workers of all kinds to people who own their own businesses. Within a 20-minute drive, for the most part, of USC, you have a wealth of experience and talent and people. It is a huge and wonderful mix of America and of Los Angeles, so that the university's attitude towards these workers, in my judgment, is a continuous threat to the whole stability of the entire community, because when they are resourcing out workers, which therefore deprive those workers both of seniority, of wages, of benefits, also of the right of their children to go to school at USC without tuition and so forth, they are really trying to undermine the entire community. And those words, an environmental threat, I think, represents really what's happened to the management of USC. Also, that management is talking about a free market economy in which they operate, which threatens the whole business of a university being a place for research and for educating future leadership and for helping people to understand themselves and their world and in the search for truth.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Reverend James Lawson, both telling us about this FAST that's starting today at the University of Southern California, and Maria Elena Durazzo, president of Local 11 since 1989. Thanks for letting us know about this union struggle that's going on in Southern California. And I want to thank everyone this past week while I was in Los Angeles who taught me a lot about activism in Southern California. And thanks especially to our Pacifica station, KPFK. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll hear from independent newspaper reporter Robert Fisk, based in Lebanon. He'll be joining us in the studio to talk about the situation in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. If you'd like a copy of today's show, which will include that speech of Kwame Ture, the excerpt you heard, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Jeremy Scahill, who will bring us another live update from Baghdad tomorrow. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!